Okay, this particular presentation is called the Copernicus Syndrome, and it is a video on demand series that takes place online. But we're going to be doing some of the presentations in the assembly from time to time as we go along. We're doing it online because it's going to be it's too long of a series to do in the assembly as a regular thing, and we do have other subjects we're trying to cover. So what we're going to do is it will be made available as video on demand. But for now, we're going to go ahead and share some parts of it. So that's what we're doing today. Okay, this is my table of contents. The first slide that I'm going to put up after this is a Bible Works note. So everybody has Bible Works, make sure you write down the information that I'm going to give you. Yes, sir? Yeah, we're trying to work through the stuff. In this particular presentation, we're going to be looking at the original followers of Yeshua. Yes, I know we're all quite familiar with them, but not as much as we think we are. This is today's presentation. Then I have to take a tangent because I've got a situation that I want you all to consider. Then we're going to talk about interpretations of text. There's going to be some resources that I'm going to recommend both to the assembly as well as those people who review this online so that you can get ahead of what the process is that we're doing. Some of these things are available in the library. We're going to look at the principles that House of David operates on, and I have a list of heavy lifters that are going to help us do this particular series, which is definitely going to go into 2015, so I'm not even going to deceive myself that this is going to get done this year. And then finally, we're going to actually look at what the Copernicus Syndrome is as I have defined it. Okay, so here is the link. If you go to BibleWorks.com/classroom, there's a series of 20 or 30 classroom studies on how to use specific things in Bible Works. And it is extremely helpful, but it's not the videos that you have in the software. It is a separate thing where they show you how to do specific things that you need to be able to do, because you're going to want to do those things. So it's going to be /classroom, and then they're listed by number. So you want to do that. All right, the plan for today, the focus is on the original followers of Yeshua. Today's presentation is an introduction to that. In 2 weeks, when we have our next meeting at the Powhatan Library, I believe the date's the 17th, I will be taking up the next part of this where we start to break down the book of Acts. As I said, this being an introduction, I want to deposit some things into your brain. Okay? I've got 4 points that I want you to think about concerning the original followers of Yeshua. The first point, obviously, I mean, this almost like goes without saying, they were believing that Yeshua was the one that had been prophesied to come to Israel. That was an identification factor. Second, they continued to observe the perfect instruction manual. And I'll explain that as we go along here, of our Heavenly Father as He gave it to Moses. I might refer to it as your PIM. 3, they supported Paul's mission to the Gentiles. And then 4, looking forward several centuries, their theology stood within the acceptable boundaries of orthodoxy. Orthodoxy means orthodox or proper belief. According to Constantine and those after Constantine, their writings state clearly that the theology of the original followers of Yeshua stood within acceptable boundaries of orthodoxy. And that's a significant point. So, now, let's go ahead and take this tangent. I've got a problematic proposition. Dave talked about suppositions recently. We had a little discussion in the assembly. So This is a problem that I'm facing. Not me personally, but I'm saying this is a problem that exists today, and I want to run it by you. And so I'm going to pose it as a question. Here we go. Ready? How can an all-knowing creator with perfect instructions, who claims to be unchanging, would finally reach a point in time where he would declare that his perfect instructions were horrible and it was time for a change? This is a problem. That's what he says. Okay, so what do we know about the author of the text? He says that, well, I don't change. Theological word is immutable. The Most High is omniscient, in other words, all-knowing. Implications. An omniscient creator is perfect, which would imply that no imperfection exists, okay? And it can't exist, otherwise he's not perfect. So, is he perfect? Or is he not perfect? And we talked about, remember we were talking about Kadosh previously? It was brought up during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And if you go and look in depth at that word, you will see the perfection. I mean, it's the maximum of certain attributes that the Almighty has. The maximum level is Kadosh. So if he's perfect and there's no imperfection and he doesn't change, then it would follow that there can't be any contradictions in what he teaches. Does that make sense? Now, if we have an intelligent creator and he's going to create the heavens and the earth, isn't that what verse 1 says? An intelligible universe. And then what happens on day 6? We show up. So, do you think it's possible there might be a purpose for that? Something to consider. I want to know what it is. All right, so here's what I submit. An intelligent creator who creates an intelligent universe and then puts us here to tend it, mind you, would not have left us unequipped to figure out what we're supposed to do. Otherwise, he ain't all that smart. I mean, we're giving him high grades here. So, I would like to think that somewhere in time and space, he has provided an instruction manual bearing his signature. What is our job? Search for it. When did he intervene in the affairs of humanity in a significant event that was beyond question? And then right after that, do we get any instructions? I mean, what does the word Torah mean? Commandment? No, it means instruction. So I'm looking for the instruction manual. This is first grade. Intelligent creator, intelligent universe. We come along on day 6 and he says, take care of things. And then he provides us with instructions. Am I really out on the edge here? I like to refer to these instructions as an operating manual for the planet Earth. I'm not saying that we can't use this on the planet Mars. But right now, that's not where I am. So I'm going to treat it as an operating manual for the planet Earth. What does he say in Psalm 19:7? The Torah of Yahweh is perfect. It has no missing parts. Wow. So, we've got this intelligent, perfect creator that has no internal contradictions, who provides instructions that have no missing parts, perfection, and there's no room for improvement. Because otherwise, they'd be missing parts. Do you think that as far as an intelligible purpose, we might be able to find out something from this instruction manual? Just a thought. Now, one of the things that I have found is that I can, and what is Leviticus about? How to relate to him, how to commune with him. In addition, we will learn how to relate to the rest of his creation. He's got creation, and he's got him. And so, he wants relationship. What does the word mean? Who was telling me that it came from the Septuagint, and what did the real Hebrew word mean? To draw near. Hey, I didn't write that. He wrote it. It wasn't Moses talking with him. It was he said, I want you to draw near. So, he's going to lay out this set of instructions. And you know what this is rhetorical, so don't answer. What is the key word that he uses to define this drawing near action? It's called love. And if you read the text, you will find great detail about what it means to love him, what it means to love your neighbor, and all the things associated with it. These are the instructions. Isn't this pretty simple? Now, what does Leviticus, what is it going to tell us? That the instruction manual sets forth the only perfect and acceptable way to do this and to do this. All right? So, here's the question that's on the table. Why would, or how is it possible that an all-knowing, perfect, let's go slow here, all-knowing, perfect, unchanging God contradict his previously perfect instruction manual? All right? Here is what I think the answer is. Either before or after he contradicts himself, he reveals himself and his previous instructions to be imperfect. I'm giving you some instructions and I'm telling you you're imperfect, and 15 minutes later I say, oh, wait a minute, I got something else to add. That's a problem. So, can we get a college degree credit for this? Or is this high school? Is this elementary school? Where are we here? Is anything here, up here, level-wise? I didn't think so. All right, next subject up is interpretation, or the art of. Would there be anybody here who would be willing to attest that in the scriptures they have found passages in which some people have had a different interpretation? Perhaps. Perhaps. All right, let's talk about resources. There are some things that we have to look at if we're going to do a complete job of understanding the original followers for the first 500 years. There's some things we got to do to get that information. Obviously, first up, the scriptures. Now, let's discuss what's not the scriptures. The Apocrypha is not the scriptures. Pseudepigraphia is not the scriptures. Early church fathers are not the scriptures. Historians of the first century are not the scriptures. Historians of the following century are not the scriptures. They're all resources, but they're not the scriptures. We don't want to forget that. However, have we not enjoyed Phil and Julie's early church fathers and the things that they have said? And joy may not be the best word choice. All right. But they had things to say. Okay. Third, how about some Jewish writings? Philo, Josephus, Talmud, Mishnah, and a variety of other Jewish sources that talk about what was happening in the first and second century. We're going to consider that. Fourth, this particular group called the original followers of Yeshua had other writings that they wrote down that we have in existence. We have them today. We will look at those as well. Five, I appreciate the work of historians because they can point me at things and say, you know, where it might take me at the library some length of time to find something, I might be able to read a historian's work, and he'll say, and the reference to this is, duh. And I can go, excellent. And in 2 minutes, I've confirmed that. And then I'm moving on. So historians do have a good role. They can help us out. And finally, a key person in understanding what's going on with the original followers of Yeshua, we all know him quite well. His name is Constantine. And we will look at his writings as they regard the original followers of Yeshua in the 4th and 5th century. All right. I said this was introductory material. I want to talk about some principles that we are going to apply to our material and that we apply on a regular basis. The first one is my primary one. The first person to present their case seems right until the next person comes forward and examines them. This is the key to success. Because as we've already, did you notice that we agreed that we have found other people who have looked at a passage and have interpreted it differently? This exists today. Yes. Yes, I lie not. So, the assembly, using principles and resources and etc., we can together examine things. And so this is a very important principle. Number two, this is a principle of jurisprudence, the weight of evidence. Sometimes we will study material and we may come out with a 90 and 10 percentage of, oh, it looks like this is it, look, pretty weighty, but then there are going to be some other situations in which, well, 60-40, 55-45, I got more work to do on that, So no concrete pouring in this assembly. Okay? Thank you. Number three, 2 Corinthians 13 and 5. Paul says to the people, the believers, examine yourselves, make a determination if you're still following the truth. I think that's a good exhortation. Good exhortation. All right. Number four. One of my favorites, 1 Thessalonians 5:21. Test everything. Now, you know what? 5:21. I'm only showing you 5:21A. There's 5:21B. Okay? Now, A says, test everything. Okay? So I tested it. What do? 5:21B gives the answer. If it's true, grasp a hold of it. If it's not, don't grasp a hold of it. Don't you love those A and B scriptures? Gotta love them. All right. The next section is called Heavy Lifters, and I'm doing this because this PDF is going to be available online, and for those people who want to get in front of what we're doing, they will have an opportunity to go to the library and check out these people. So I'm giving you some books with authors and a little bit of information so that you can be aware of some of the materials that will be examined in addition to what I've already told you. Okay? The first one, you will hear me refer to this as Becker and Reed, but this is the ways that never parted Jews and Christians in late antiquity and the early Middle Ages. We were told that at some point in time, Jews and Christians divided. It turns out that's not true. It never happened. And we're going to expose it in this presentation, this series of presentations. So one good book, heavy lifter, is Becker and Reed. Adam Becker and Annette Reed. Next, Hellenist and Hebrews, Reassessing Division Within the Earliest Church. Yes, Reassessing Division. 3, Jacob Neusner's Judaism and Christianity in the Age of Constantine. This is where we're going to see how things appeared and how they weren't really true. Paul was not a Christian. The original message of a misunderstood apostle. I'm currently reading this one. Pamela Eisenbaum does an excellent job. She does. This is by Daniel Bayerin. The Jewish Gospels, the story of the Jewish Christ. He is a Talmudic scholar, and I've also started reading this one. And what he does is he goes through the Gospels and explains how everything that Yeshua did was perfectly Jewish and lined up with the times of the first century. And he's a Talmudic scholar. I've read one review of his works in which he's recognized as one of the top 5 scholars in the world today alive. And then I read another review of his work in which a particular rabbi said he's probably the top Talmudic scholar in the world. And he has broken down the 4 Gospels and demonstrated how everything there was Jewish. Awesome read. Okay, another area that we're going to discuss is going to be archaeology. So we have a couple of those. Here's one, The Church from the Circumcision, History and Archaeology of the Judeo-Christians, by Brigetti. Next, we have Jewish Christianity in Acts. That's the book we're going to discuss. In the Light of the Qumran Scrolls. Yes, Fitzmyer, a major author. And isn't this the question that has to be asked? Who was a Jew? Significant. And this is by Schiffman. Okay, the last page of this, Nazarene Jewish Christianity, from the end of the New Testament period until its disappearance in the 4th century, by Raymond Pritz. Another archaeological book, Archaeological Discoveries Relative to Judeo-Christians, by Mancini. And following, we all know this guy, this particular author, Formation of the Christian Church, by Skip Moen, in which he demonstrates how the Christian church was invented and then created for a very specific purpose. And we were never told why, but we're going to find out. So, okay, so there's my heavy lifters. This is just a few of some of these resources that we'll be looking at over the months to come. All right, so let's go to the Copernicus syndrome. Let's find out who Nicholas Copernicus was. We probably all studied him in our science courses in school. Not that I can remember, but probably somebody mentioned his name. These are the years that he lived. I have a list of things about him that is really interesting. All right, you ready? He was a classical scholar, a translator, an artist, a mathematician, a jurist, a diplomat, a physician, and a governor. Yeah, and he's not known for any of that. But what was his hobby? Astronomy. And that's what he's known for. Yeah. So I'm going to sum this up as gifted gentleman. You know, I think that's fair. He was a gifted gentleman. All right, now, Who were some future scientists he influenced that you know? Anybody recognize Kepler? We'll talk about him in a second. How about Galileo? We're going to talk about him in a second, too. Newton. Anybody heard of Isaac Newton? These are some names. All right. Let's talk about Kepler just for a second. I want you to understand influences here. Kepler devised the three laws of planetary motion that are still used by NASA today. So that's pretty good. He did some stuff. Now, when Kepler discovered, he was building his work on the work of Copernicus. And this is what led him to developing these three laws of planetary motion. So he's a Christian gentleman. A Christian gentleman. So what do you think an astronomer, Christian gentleman, wants to do? He wants to find the star of Bethlehem. Okay. So, needless to say, he doesn't have computers like we have today, so he had to do this on a day basis and draw charts. As much as like visual aids, you know. Now, here's the problem. He went looking for the star of Bethlehem based on the information he had and the information he had as far as how the heavens move and all this other stuff. He had calculated it correctly, and he went after finding the star of Bethlehem because he wanted to line it up with the scriptures, which, of course, we have some discussion about the events of the birth of Yeshua in Matthew and in Luke. So, he's trying to do this, and he needs a historical source to be able to place everything in the timeline of the first century. So, what does everybody use? Everybody uses Josephus. Ah, but there lies the problem. He was using a copy of Josephus that had been printed on the printing press. And it had an error that he didn't know about. So he tried to establish the Star of Bethlehem and could not find it. And for 350 years, based on the work of Josephus and scientists like Kepler, Protestant Christianity looked for the Star of Bethlehem and could not find it. They didn't know there was an error. And then something happened. A discussion took place amongst some scholars. And they said, you know, the date that you're using for Josephus to establish this timeline, I think that's wrong. I remember seeing a manuscript over in Venice, and it said something else. And there's like, ooh. So now there's this discussion about, what we got to figure this out. So what happened was finally a scholar stepped forth and said, you know what? Why don't we go back and take a look at the Josephus manuscripts before the printing press came into existence? I'll go to the British Library and the Library of Congress, and I'll look at every manuscript that exists in those two libraries to make a determination about what was said prior to the printing press. Lo and behold, he found the error. Where the number 20 was in the printed copies, the number 22 was in the original copies. And so when they put that together, and I've already done a teaching on this, that's why I'm only giving you a quick review. When they put all the pieces together, they found the Star of Bethlehem and everything timed out just right. But it took a while to get there. And why am I bringing up this tangent? Because of the subject that I'm covering. It's called a contaminated evidentiary source. And that is a situation where you depend on this document here, and you don't even know that it contains an error, and you're basing all your work on it. That's a problem. So, I'm just saying. All right, now, let's look at the situation Copernicus found himself in. I love this. Let's go back in time, 262 BCE, 190. This is a couple hundred years before Yeshua. it was determined by the astronomers and mathematicians and scientists of the time that the Earth was the center of the universe. Okay? So we feel good about ourselves, don't we? We feel good about ourselves. All right. So this scientific inquiry was formalized by Ptolemy in the second century after the birth of Yeshua. All right, think. Second century, that's like 200. All right. Now, what took place in the 15th century? Second century, 15th century. That's not last year. That's not in the last decade. That's not the last century. That's not even the last millennium. Way in. All right. Scientists and mathematicians, they said the Earth is the center of the universe. Philosophers said the Earth was the center of the universe. Hey, now look, I'm not a scientist, not a mathematician, I'm not a philosopher. Well, then, dude, walk outside and stand there all day. Does the sun go around the Earth? Yes. It's observable by all people. Do you have eyes? Look up. But that's not enough. You would think that would be enough, but no, I'm not stopping there. The Roman Catholic Church had an interpretation of the scriptures. It was clear what the text said. No debate. They're the only church, by the way. All right. So, what text did they base this on? Psalm 104, verse 5. Let me put that verse up for you. In the English, it says, "He established the earth upon its foundations, so it should never be moved." Therefore, they determined that there was no way the earth could circle the sun. Therefore, anybody who comes up with that idea is heretical. Yes. That's a problem. Okay, now, I'm dropping out of my PowerPoint so I can show you some text. For those of you who don't remember, Jerome took the scriptures in the 4th century and translated it into Latin. And that text became the text of the Catholic Church. You might be familiar with the name Vulgate. Okay, I'm putting up the text. Then we'll come back to this slide. Okay. Here is the Latin text for 104.5. Just ignore the 103. Some of these things are numbered differently. In the Vulgate, it's numbered differently from your English translation. I want you to notice the last two words here. Saeculum, saeculum. Now, what is the English version of the Vulgate? It's called the Douay Rheims Bible. And the translation of the text is, "Who has founded the earth upon its own basis? It shall not be moved forever and ever." Now that's odd, because I went to Google Translate of Latin to English to look to see what saeculum meant. And it means age. Oh, well, what are the two Greek words at the bottom of the slide? From aeon to aeon. What did we learn about aeon last year? It doesn't mean forever. It means age. If you look at the Hebrew text, it says olam. So here we have an English translation that established the doctrine of the earth being the center of the universe for over 1,000 years, but it was not correct. All right, let's keep going. I now give credit to Dave. A presupposition is an implicit assumption about the world or a belief. relating to an utterance whose truth is taken for granted. So, the entire world took for granted that the earth was the center of the universe because everybody said it was. It's called a presupposition. My position is they didn't test everything. When you get new information, what is the minimum requirement in this covenant? Test everything. All right. So what did he do? New evidence was presented to be considered. But what happened? He had it all laid out. The Catholic Church actually supported it. But what happened was the results of what he was saying he found challenged the interpretation of the church. And they said, no. We are in charge of what the scriptures mean. Not you. Therefore, be gone. It didn't stop with him. I have to give you another example as we end this presentation, when I end this presentation later. What they did was they did not test when they got the new information. They did not consider it. They said, talk to the hand. Okay? But we have another example in Paul. What happened with Paul? Paul's in the first century. He's brought up at the feet of one of the leading rabbis of the first century. Do you think he knew the scriptures? I'm going to go out on a limb here and say, yeah. Okay? So, did he have an interpretation about the one who was prophesied to come to Israel? Yeah. And guess what? Yeshua ain't him. That was his interpretation of the scriptures. And he was very, can I use the word motivated? To stomp out everyone who interpreted those scriptures that Yeshua was the Messiah. And he testifies to that in different places. And we will look at that in time. But what happened? Oh, let me give you a couple points here about him, just so you can understand. In Acts 26, he says he's a voting member of those leaders in Jerusalem who made a determination to put people in prison and to put them to death if they said Yeshua was the appointed one. He cast the white stone, the black stone. And you'll see that in opposite in Revelation 2:17 when the white stone is cast on our behalf. So I'm just letting you know that we have plenty of evidence about Paul's position concerning the situation. So, new evidence was presented to Paul. When did that take place? The road to Emmaus. What new information did Paul get? Yeshua is Lord. What did Paul do? Talk to the hand? No. All right. So, later in Acts, what do we see Paul doing? He goes into the synagogue with the exact same scriptures and has got the complete opposite interpretation. Yeshua is not the Messiah. Yeshua is the Messiah. Did the scriptures change? No. But he got a piece of information that changed his baseline on how he was going to interpret the text. Follow what I'm saying? I call this case where one immediately challenged his presupposition and changed his basis for interpreting the scriptures. And remember, this Copernicus system, what am I talking about in this series? I am talking about those who say that when Yeshua died, it is finished means that everything that the way it was being done had come to a stop. What do the scriptures say? Let's take a look. So, Paul made a change. Let's take a look at another group of people who fell into this same situation. Religious leaders in the first century, what did they believe? We're sons of Abraham, therefore, we are in. What did John the Baptist say? Stones you are in. In essence, that's what he said. So it kind of reminds me of the scenario that we face today. I, coming out of Southern Baptist, Protestant Christian, Charismatic, and whatever was after that, I was told the goal is getting saved. That's what I was told the goal was. How surprised was I to find out that that wasn't the goal? Getting the inheritance is the goal. Being saved is being called. And the text says many are called, few are chosen. Let's reinterpret that. Many are saved, few receive the inheritance. Let's do a math quiz. How many people came out of Egypt? Quite a few. How many people received the inheritance? Two. Now, what is those percentages? I don't think I like those percentages. So it ain't about being saved. I used to think that some meritorious act on my part allowed me to be saved. No, God called me. Thank goodness. And now it's time. And what did we discuss last year? The key to the entire thing is the unjust steward of Luke 16. We have to know that we are looking for the inheritance which does not perish. And everything that's taking place right now is about gaining the inheritance. What did Yeshua say in Luke 20, 34 to 36? Those who are found worthy to enter into the Shabbat. That's the inheritance. So the religious leaders, blood of Abraham, I'm in. I was a Southern Baptist, get saved, I'm in. These deceptions are driving me crazy, people. I've got to get this sorted out. Wasn't it Jeremiah who had a famous saying? We've inherited lies. Yes. Okay. Now, Paul, in one of those few times when he was clearer than glass, and there are very few, he said, "For they are not all Israel who are of Israel." And that is the key to this. All right, so continuing here. What we have seen, and I just gave you three examples, and I'm going to give you one more here. People, groups, get new information. Some change their basis for understanding what God said. Others did not. But the minimum requirement in this covenant is to test everything. Because we've been given section of land, some money, some other little things that we've got. And he's looking down to see how we, as stewards of what he owns, are going to manage what he gave us responsibility for to determine if we're even qualified to receive the inheritance. So I need to be real sure here about who's who. I ain't God. We're clear on that. Got that sorted out during the homework time. So need to refocus here on what he expects of me. Because what are we studying? Leviticus. What is the definition of a priest? One that intercedes between A and B. You're a kingdom of priests. Find out what your job is. See if you qualify. Okay, so I've given you some examples. Now, there's another example. This is my final example. I just want you to see that over time, people do change. Some initially maintain their position, but eventually change, like several hundred years later. So, here's it. Well, you know, there is a problem with that, depending on how long you live. You know, but I'm trying to be flexible here. All right. New York Times, October 31st, 1992. Here's what it said. After 350 years, the Vatican says Galileo was right. The earth moves. Yeah, they put him in jail. They made him recant under burning at the stake. Of course, he recanted. And then he died. And this has been a sore spot for the Catholic Church. They admitted as much. So, a formal statement at the Pontifical Academy of Sciences on Saturday, I should put the date, Vatican officials said the Pope will formally close a 13-year investigation into the Church's condemnation of Galileo in 1633 because they admitted that what they did was wrong, they should have tested everything, and they chose not to. No, it took them 13 years to investigate what happened. Yeah. 13 years to evaluate the trial. The trial lasted 2 days. They must have done...
What I'm trying to say is they probably took lessons from the Supreme on state.
Oh, okay. All right. So anyway, I thought that was good that they came to a place where they said, you know, he was right all along. And we didn't listen, and we just said, talk to the hand. Okay, so there you go. So, sometimes a literal read of the scriptures, as they did, can be perceived incorrectly. And so, that's why one of the things you will hear a lot in this assembly is, what does the text say? Somebody tell me what the text says about that. I appreciate that you don't feel like the earth moves. But tell me what the text says. Okay? So, for us, what does that mean? That means that we're going to have to go back to the Hebrew and the Greek because I want to be sure of what I'm reading. Because this is a concern to me. Even Josephus was messed up by the printer changing one digit from a 2 to a 0, messed up 350 years of genuine research. One act that probably took, what does it take to typeset one single letter? 6 seconds? 6 second era, 350 years of disaster. We got to get in it. We got to get in it. Okay? So, to reject the text because we don't like what it says. Did the Catholic Church like what it said? No. Because they wanted to appear to be the ones who had the interpretation correct. And for them to hint that, you know, maybe we interpreted this text wrong, what would the people say? Could they have interpreted something else wrong? Then it all comes crashing down. So that's why we don't pour concrete here. We say, this is what I found. What do you think? So, I ask you, what is the Copernicus syndrome? We desire to know and walk in the truth. Sometimes we can previously suppose that something is true, and then later on, we find out that it's not. So, to keep that from happening, there's only one thing that we have to do. When new information makes itself available, we need to give it a fair hearing. And I think that that is what our Heavenly Father would like for us to do as relates to moving from called/saved to gaining the inheritance. Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians list all the reasons why you will not enter into the kingdom. And there's many more discussions about how you can be sure to miss receiving your inheritance. I think that for this one, we can make sure that we give new information a fair hearing. Because I don't want to be on the other end. I'm not going to last 350 years. That's all I have. Are there any questions?